Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another in the Berlinale series, and I'm here with a debut guest on the podcast. I'm very happy to welcome Kiva York, who will be filing a piece for Reverse Shot out of the festival, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is this your first time at the festival as well? Or?
It is indeed. I've been to Berlin as a city a bunch of times before. I've enjoyed it as a city, and now I'm here in a totally different mindset in Potsdamer Platz, which I view as kind of a space unto itself in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And all festivals are kind of like weird toy towns, pretty much. So.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we're all toys in various states of batteries running down.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's start with a movie that I was very curious to see, knowing the director's work as a writer in prose. I was very curious what her movie would be like. It's a feature film, Une Famille. The director and writer is Christine Angot, who is, a big cultural figure in France. Do you want to say a bit about her and the film?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I must admit that I first sort of encountered her name in the context of Claire Denis' work. She was the co-author of a couple of Denis' more recent films, Both Sides of the Blade and Let the Sunshine In, both of which star Juliette Binoche. Everyone listening to this podcast knows this, I'm sure.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I almost forgot to mention that she co-wrote those, yeah.
Yeah, and I think like in those films and in her association with Claire Denis, coming to sort of learn a bit more about her as a cultural figure and as a writer, I was like, ah, yes, this fits. But basically in France, I think she's quite a well-known / notorious figure, in particular for her 1999 novel, sort of a work of autofiction called Incest. This came off the back of, I think, a few novels that were exploring this theme in part, the autobiographicality or the autofictionality, if I can just quickly coin some terms here, of those texts, I think was unclear, but with L'Inceste, it was made quite explicit. Apparently, this was only translated into English in 2017, but certainly she became a figure of notoriety and was on sort of talk shows, and some of this footage is actually in this film, which is a documentary, sort of another angle into this trauma that has obviously, of course, shaped her life in many ways.
And it's thinking of the best way to describe it. I mean, it's like partly her reflections and then partly a series of interviews or in some cases confrontations or reckonings that she does with different people from her past. And just as a way to move through things, I thought that was... I don't know the book.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I actually haven't read the book myself.
Okay.
A friend who has, who also speaks French, she was telling me she actually was not so into the film. She thought it didn't really add to the book. But having seen the film and not having read the book, I was quite surprised because to me it felt very specifically cinematic and like there were new encounters and these new confrontations and the sort of stratification of the different kinds of responses she's getting from the people that she speaks to in her family, in her life, were really harrowing, of course, but also revealing and yes, sort of settled into like quite a crystalline, like sedimented structure that to me spoke very clearly and loudly. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like, how you describe that. I mean, maybe it would help if we just said that it was her father.
Oh yes. That's important. Yeah.
So I think, one of the major conversations she has early in the movie is with her stepmother.
Yeah.
That's the one where it feels like she's really literally kind of has to push through the door.
The moment where that happens was it actually really like, I feel like a tension in the cinema just sort of like snap crackle popped a little bit. Like there's one like sound of like the door being sort of shoved open. It's like, oh, okay, this is serious. But maybe to put it in a bit of context. Yeah. Before we get ahead of ourselves. Yeah. Her father was, she had like a sexual relationship with her father for some period beginning from when she was 13. So this was, obviously she could not consent to this, but I think she did not grow up with him and he sort of, upon meeting her, like instigated this, began to rape her at intervals. And yeah, so I think this first, pretty much the first incident or the first major scene in the film is this confrontation with her stepmom. And it's occasioned by the fact that she is releasing a new book, Voyage dans l'Est, like Voyage to the East. And so she is going to Strasbourg to you know, launch the book, to do a book signing, and that is where her father lived, her stepmother lived. Her father has passed, but she rings up her stepmom, leaves a message just sort of being like, hey, I think maybe we should talk. It's obviously been years, but, you know, maybe that's why also it's a good time to talk.
Yeah.
So when she turns up at the door, you know, it hasn't been prearranged with the stepmom, but also maybe the stepmom should have expected it, should have returned the call. But I think it's important also to say at this point that, of course, this is being filmed and who it's being filmed by and why it's being filmed.
Yeah.
And so she is with Caroline Champetier, excuse me.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Who is a friend and also a very, you know, established cinematographer, has worked a lot with a number of, you know, huge directors. I mean, I think got the Berlin Camera Award like last year.
Yeah, I want to say she's worked with like Leo Carax, or
yeah, she shot Annette. So. But yeah, has been around for ages, very, very huge name.
Yeah.
And a friend. And so this camera and this person are kind of fulfilling the same role for Ango in this moment of bearing witness and being a support. And, you know, she tells her stepmom, who's obviously surprised to see her and surprised to see a camera, you know, I was alone throughout this whole experience. And so now I need a witness and I need support and I need someone sort of, quote unquote, on my side to see what I see as my friend does, as the camera does.
Yeah.
But obviously it adds a huge level of tension and confrontation to turning up at someone's house.
Yeah. Partly because her stepmother doesn't have control. And although she later tries to exert control in a way that Ango is very shocked and angered by how this comes back. But yeah, I like what you're saying, that Champetier is there as a witness, as a friend.
Oh, I do want to also, before we move on from that scene, just because I think that scene was what kind of like locked me in. And it feels almost cheap to say this, but I don't know if you were noticing, I was really sort of mesmerized by the dynamic in the conversation, which is quite horrifying, the things that the stepmom is saying, still this sort of like total lack, denial of any kind of responsibility or even a willingness to know, even at this point with him dead. But the color scheme is really crazy. The whole house is kind of gold and white, and then the stepmom is there dressed in gold and white, and you know, she's not expecting anyone, so this is the fact that it looks staged, and she's, you know, this very sort of like bourgeois seeming woman's perched on this white couch in her golden pants, denying any inkling of knowledge or responsibility. Yeah. It kind of, in an inverse way, it was actually kind of reminding me of, I don't know if you've seen or if you would remember the scene I'm thinking of, but there's a scene in Werner Herzog's Lo and Behold, his like internet documentary, where he interviews a family about a horrific tragedy that's happened in their life, but the way they are staged around the kitchen table, and there's sort of this like plate of muffins in the foreground, and you know, knowing Herzog, he probably did stage this to some degree, but this scene in the Ango documentary, a completely different feel, did for me evoke the sort of eeriness of a like ecstatic truth staged Herzog moment in that doc.
I think there's also this hideous painting that's looming in the background
as well. Yeah, like a crappy de Kooning. De Kooning if it was in a hotel.
Yeah. Somehow it's reflecting the turmoil. And yeah, she's just trying to gloss over everything in kind of, you know, bourgeois formality and excuses. But Ango is unsurprisingly like very iron-willed about it. I just found the movie generally has this amazing combination of an iron will, but also vulnerability, but just like kind of a laser focus, especially seeing, I mean, in this instance, she has to be sort of aggressive in a way. In other dialogues, she is guiding it, but with a gentle firmness in a way. So I was just interested in how she knows and how she's able to just kind of deploy these different ways of engaging. It's like she's very familiar with all the different offense and defense mechanisms people have.
Mm-mm-mm. As, you know, someone who I'm sure has read her work or seen either of those Denis films that she has co-written the script for would anticipate that she understands those mechanisms.
Yeah.
But yeah, I let the iron will and the vulnerability thing. It's like she has made up her mind extremely strongly to be vulnerable, and nothing can deter her from that or make her feel shame around that. And that opening scene is kind of countered by a scene at the end with her daughter, and that's, yeah, there's there is catharsis in this movie. Although in the Q&A, I saw the Q&A for this one, Christine Engel was sort of arguing against or cautioning against, rather, the idea of using art as therapy. For this, she recommends psychoanalysis. So just...
It's interesting to hear that, because in a way you could say that she's acting so many roles in some of these encounters. I mean, certainly when she is talking with her daughter.
Yeah, her daughter with her ex-husband, who's also an interviewee in the film.
Who's also an interviewee. Like, yeah. In each of those cases, yeah, she's really the combination of like drawing out or hanging back, you know, all these many layers.
And it takes place in the present day and sort of taking into account the expanse of her life and also like her daughter's life. We get sort of like home video footage of her daughter woven in, which is like, first you're like, oh, how sweet, and then you're like, oh my god, like, no, this is very dark indeed.
Yeah. The combination of just the sort of raw emotional confrontation of it, it has a very careful structure, but it also doesn't feel like it has to fulfill some dramatic expectation.
No, it doesn't feel beholden to delivering anything, certainly. Even though I've found at the end there was sort of like, oh my god, like, okay, you got somewhere. Someone said something that was not completely insensitive and insane.
Yeah. Well, yeah, just to say that it is its own standalone work. Well, I'm not even going to try a segue here.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what you say now. I'm not helping you.
Yeah, respectfully, I'm just going to silently like put down that one movie, that one book, and we'll pick up another title by way of showing the sometimes definitely absurd range of films that you'll go through, although these were not viewed on the same day, at least. But more recently screened in the festival is, I think it's fair, I usually bridle against calling things a Netflix movie, but I think in this case I can call it a Netflix movie for any number of reasons.
I think for contractual reasons Adam Sandler might need you to call it a Netflix movie.
Exactly. We speak, of course, of the opus Spaceman, which unfortunately, because of 30 Rock, I almost say
Spaceman.
Spaceman. Although I have to say that's one thing that I thought was pretty funny in the movie. In a movie that is not trying to be funny, you know, really.
No, quite the opposite.
Yeah. Adam Sandler is the spaceman of the title. He's somewhere up there. It's sort of been a while since I saw this now, so I actually don't remember why he's there. Is he there to fix something?
He is kind of there to fix something. It's a bit of an Ad Astra type situation. I read some of the book, and I must admit that I had to stop for personal sanity reasons.
Is it a Czech book or is it?
It's interesting. It's by a Czech American author. It's from about 7 years ago, 2017, however long ago that may be. Mm-hmm. I think now lives in America, but he wrote it in English. But it is about, it's sort of a speculative fiction or alternative recent history fiction about the big pink aurora borealis type cloud picture, the Simpsons quote right now, like localized in your backyard, occurring in the sky, and someone needs to go check that out. No pun intended, but it's going to happen a lot. And as it happens, it turns out that Czech Republic sort of like, this is going to be our thing that we do. We're going to put the man in space. He's going to get a sample of the big pink cloud situation, which is called Chopra.
Wow, I do not remember this at all.
See, that's, and now I'm getting confused because I've only seen the film once, and yeah, I think it's more foregrounded in the book perhaps.
Okay.
I think it's there in the film, but it's like pretty muted as the entire film is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in the film if it is less foregrounded in the movie, maybe they didn't want to like create this whole mythology or this whole backdrop.
It's kind of an anti-thriller, like,
yeah.
Yeah,
totally. That's the great word for it. It's an anti-thriller because he goes up in space, and it's kind of in the subgenre of the sad astronaut movie.
Mm.
You know, Ad Astra or
Sad Astra. Sorry.
Now do Interstellar.
Okay. I didn't have any prep on this.
So yeah, he's up there. He's the total opposite of most of what you associate with Adam Sandler. Like, there's not even the kind of neurotic engine of an Uncut Gems. It's just...
Mm. I think he has one moment of saying like, oh, but like, that's the closest he gets. I was like, oh, it's happening. And then there were no other outbursts. But it's really a Sandler drained of certainly joie de vivre, and even energy. And it's like, you know, there's stuff in the film about him being this ambitious guy. Like, basically, he has gone to space to do this, like, very globally important mission. For some reason, Isabella Rossellini is the spokesperson on Earth for this globally important mission to catch the pink dust. sorry, it's really hard not to do this, not to adopt this tone. After just talking about such a heavy thing, let us have fun with this one.
This is true, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we should mention the other half of the access is just that Carey Mulligan plays his wife. I was just trying to remember if they are estranged already at the time the movie is taking place, because it's also getting mixed up with what's in the memory, you know. This is actually a symptom of many sad astronaut movies, I think, a kind of quicksand mire of present and past that is this kind of a manifestation of just like ruminating, which honestly is probably what like being in space alone is like, right?
You're just,
you know,
which is why I'm not signing up.
You're not signing up, okay.
Yeah. So he's, I think, like what's prompting his melancholy predominantly at the point at which we meet him. I believe maybe we meet him on the cusp of realizing his wife's not picking up the phone, essentially.
Yes.
She's gone AWOL. They have some sort of like interstellar Skype going on.
Right, right.
There's like a big like hub in her house and she's just sort of left it. So she's just gone off. She's sort of like, my husband has abandoned me for, you know, the safety of the world. And he's coming to reassess his sort of life priorities and his great ambition. It's just very interesting because I know we're meeting him at this specific point in time, but we also see flashbacks of them sort of falling in love and doing whatever. And he still seems like a pretty mild-mannered sort.
Yeah.
And he's not, we don't get any like montage of him, you know, frantically drawing on the blackboard, being like, okay, honey, like, this is what we're going to do. This is what I'm going to do. And you'll be right here, right? But yeah, I think I have to say, like, definitely curiosity. I was very curious about this film. Like, I liked Hustle, the last film that Adam Sandler did for Netflix, which was also kind of a more downbeat type situation, or him in a more downbeat role, like, you know, talking about how in middle age you don't have dreams anymore, you have eczema or something. I was like, oh, okay, we're in a new phase. But that's still a heartwarming
film. That's still a bit of a,
one-liner. So I was curious about this, but I did have some alarm bells going off when I read. Oh, and we should mention the director is Johan Renck, Swedish dude who did Chernobyl, I think is his predominant fame to claim.
Yes, that is kind of the skeleton key to all of it in a way, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a show I have not been able to enter.
Me too. Oh, no. I've tried to enter it and I have sort of mild psychological burns from it. So I really, really didn't like it.
So one other element, I guess, worth mentioning is that, and the reason Paul Dano is credited in this film, he voices a like arachnid.
Spider? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Creature. I thought it was like a kind of hallucination, but then I read described in a completely different way in something I just read. But it's this quiet
and zen-like presence that is either being hallucinated by sad Czech spaceman Adam Sandler. We should specify his name is like Jakub Prokushna. I'm going to mangle that Czech last name, excuse me.
Yeah.
But of course, it's Renck doesn't believe in accents, so you know everyone's just being themselves, except sadder. And yeah, I think he's kind of not meant to be a figment, but you, Hanush, the arachnid character who's given, bestowed this name by Adam Sandler, and they sort of, Hanush sort of course is acting, I was personally thinking about like the Christmas Carol watching this film, because he's sort of like, he's actually reaching into Adam Sandler's mind, the character's mind, and pulling up certain memories and forcing him to realize that he's been selfish and he hasn't noticed that he wasn't connecting with his wife. At the end, or towards the end, he and Jakob, the Sandler character, have a big hug, which was pretty weird.
Yeah. I mean, I liked imagining a creature like that as what would be in the ship with him, because there are other options, and for some reason it reminds me of Robert Aldrich. I want to get this right. I'll probably get it wrong. I think he maybe was going to do something, and he was trying to figure out how to visualize. And the idea he had was a shaven orangutan. I mean, I always appreciate these, like, whiteboard sort of, like,
Yep.
Because that seems so crazy, but in a way, maybe it's right, and maybe someone should do something like that. Or maybe there even is a movie that has something like that. Is there one?
I think I've seen some, like, shaved dogs on Twitter, and that's been a good time.
Just something, yeah. But just something that's, you know, sort of estranged from what's familiar. So I appreciated that, you know, it's a very well-designed creature and concept, I thought.
But it's interesting because the film is, like, quite psychedelic in that sense. You've got Sad Sandman talking to Zen Paul Dano Spider.
Yeah.
There's the big pink Chopra cloud outside. There's sort of quite trippy, like, almost vignetted memories that are sort of being drawn out of his head. And there's a very, like, cool score by, like, Max Richter. Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of attention to detail and, like, the aesthetic, the fine, the texture and the grain of it. And it's all kind of like Soviet-y vibe on the spaceship, slovenly Soviet vibe. And yet it feels rather dirge-like. And to finish the thought I had before, like, the alarm bells for me kind of went off when I read a quote from Johan Rank that's been doing the rounds of sort of like, I wanted to present like an Adam Sandler that you've never seen before. Like, I wanted to do something with him that no one's done before. And, you know, then I think about, like, Paul Thomas Anderson talking about casting him in Punch Drunk Love. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this is a Adam Sandler movie. It's just written differently. And I think when you say something like, I want, of course, you know, you want to cast someone against type, and particularly comedians, that can be, like, really incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just an accident of phrasing, but I'm like, don't you want to use what he's good at?
Yeah, it's definitely not how you've seen him before. I'll give him that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting in a sense in that way. And I have to give him something for trying that.
Yeah. You
know, totally. Like, he did not have to do a solo sad, you know, astronaut.
No. Strapped in a whole bunch of harnesses. And yet the bandwidth that he operates within in this film is, like, kind of remarkable in itself. I just don't think the film quite works around it, or doesn't manage to quite energize that. Or,
well, such is Spaceman. But let's go from the massive, in the sense of a big Netflix production, to the Critics Week, Berlin Critics Week, which is a thriving festival of its own. And I'm glad to have you update me on what's been going on there,
sure.
Because I did not really make it there.
It's like a parallel, it's an independent parallel section, kind of like the idea is that it's counter-programming, but also, of course, there's sort of resonance between the festivals. The tricky part is it's, you know, a week of evenings, usually a short and a feature, and then followed by sort of a long discussion, debate with the filmmakers and usually a couple other guests who may or may not come from the world of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a really cool program, but also I think it's my first time in Berlin. It's my first time at Berlinale and Berlin Critics Week, so I'm struggling to figure out, like, how much cross-pollination goes on between these two festivals. But I've seen, I wanted to just, like, throw light on some cool stuff that I've seen there. I was just watching, a name that will be well-known probably to sort of New York, at least, listeners is Graham Swan. Graham Swan's second feature played Berlin Critics Week, an evening song for three voices. Swan, of course, being a producer of, like, Ricky D'Ambrose and Dan Salad, and did a Helena and Hermia, Matias Pinheiro's film.
Mm-hmm.
So he wears a few hats, but as a filmmaker, he has, like, an aesthetic all his own, one that is really sort of on display in quite a staggering way, I think, in the second feature, which is kind of like a strange love triangle melodrama set in 1939 between sort of urbane couple writers of different sorts, poet and like a sort of pulp writer played by Hannah Gross and Peter Vack, who move to the Midwest and end up employing this young woman, very pious, seems quite shy and maybe naive, also seems to have been affected by has had some terrible accident, her body has burns on it, but they hire her as a maid, and then there's sort of a weird, like, psychodrama that goes on between them, and maybe some hints of the supernatural and or just spookiness, which was also very much the tenor of Graham's first film, but in a different way.
What was the title of his first one again? I'm blanking.
The World is Full of Secrets. It's really beautiful. And that both films have very lush color palettes and cinematography and, like, very strong cinematographic decisions. Mm-hmm. Both were shot by Barton Courtwright, who I think also did the Ricky D'Ambrose films, but these look completely different. Hmm. And I want to shout out, in the debate after the screening, Graham was explaining how this was shot, and I have very poor technical knowledge, so I may well misrepresent this, but this new one, An Evening Song, was shot using a digital camera, but a digital camera kind of harnessed to a large format analog camera. Hmm. So like you're getting this bluesy, I don't think that's a word, but imagine that it was very like soft, blooming, watercolory type of texture, and also a very heavy vignetting effect because, quote, there's a lot of light fall off. I think I kind of know what that means, but not really.
Okay.
Perhaps others do. So there's a kind of surreality, and like the idea of a perspective mm-hmm. is built in. And that's also, you know, exacerbated, amplified by the fact that the title is An Evening Song for Three Voices. Indeed, the voices of the three characters do kind of shepherd you through this retrospective, strange story. And yeah, it's like, for me, I get sort of like Guy Madden cross early Terrence Malick vibes, mm-hmm. but plus a little bit of, well, a bunch of other stuff mm-hmm. specific to this guy and to this time. But yeah, that was quite a magical one.
Cool. And then you saw a short film, too, that you liked from an Indonesian filmmaker.
Yes. Yeah, someone who I wasn't familiar with. A filmmaker and, like, artist and curator called Riar Rizaldi. Mm-hmm. I saw his short Notes from Gog Magog, which is, like, 15 minutes, and it's kind of bifurcated. It's, like, split into two. Each half is a narrated kind of semi-creepy story, mm-hmm. but also very banal, about a workplace incident. In one, it's a guy narrating, talking about working down at the docks in Jakarta, moving containers around for Samsung, and how he hears a story from a colleague one day that everything was late, everyone had to work late, and they find out, or the word is, that everything was late because a fellow worker got crushed by a container.
Oh, I was afraid something like you were going to say something like that.
It's only going to get worse. It's a scary film, actually. This is almost a horror film, and in a moment I'll attempt to weave that in. But there's a bunch of like conceptual links that I find really fascinating and like generative in this film, or the sort of framing of this film. Rizaldi is, I think, quite interested in, like, well, obviously, like tech and capitalism and global capitalism. Mm-hmm. So the flip side of that story is a woman narrating an episode from her work day or late working night in an office in South Korea, and she also works for Samsung, and she talks about having an encounter with a ghost and then some sort of hellish portal. Again, voiceover narration over sort of like locked off shots of the environment. Both segments sort of culminate in quite horrifying AI generated animation depicting the sort of ghostly, in one case depicting the sort of crushed worker, the idea of that, mm-hmm. and in the second case depicting sort of ghost encounters. So this woman, apparently, this filmmaker Rizaldi, was speaking about how apparently there's sort of an offshoot of Samsung is sort of these suicide hotline offices where people who work for the company specifically can call when they are having suicidal ideation. And this woman, this film is based on sort of reports, anecdotes from people who work in both of these places. So, you know, this is sort of drawing on and the sort of real cost. So the use of AI is not just like, oh, it's hip, it's now, and it's weird. But Samsung is working on AI. There's a bit in the film about the, you know, quote from the CEO or someone talking about how the new AI is going to bring about, you know, happiness and contentment and all these things. And meanwhile, we've got this horrifying animation and the sort of thought of real human cost to this technology. And also it's sort of ironic to use the technology to create something terrifying, very like YouTube jump scare vibe. But yeah, so I thought that one was really, really interesting.
Yeah, no, thank you. See if I can watch that. Unfortunately, we'll probably have to bring things in for a landing there, but thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. Happy festival.
Yeah, happy festival to you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.